You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 20th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, Moscow plays host to a summit with the Taliban. But what does the Kremlin stand to gain from the talks? Also ahead, Poland accuses the European Union of blackmail in a spat over the rule of law. We'll have the very latest from Warsaw. Plus a roundup from the Balkans and Monocle's Welsh contingent. Tell us why their homeland wants them back.
When I left Wales, and perhaps for the last 15 or 16, 17 years, I'd never even contemplated the idea of moving back to Wales. I always perhaps considered that if I'd ever go home, it would be to London. But that's completely changed now.
And the latest newspapers from our Zurich headquarters too. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. North Korea has confirmed it has successfully tested a new submarine-launched ballistic missile. Health leaders in England have said that some COVID restrictions must be reintroduced immediately if the country is to avoid stumbling into a winter crisis. And the 73rd Frankfurt Book Fair opens today under the moniker Reconnect. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, Russia has, until now, played a delicate game when it comes to the return of Taliban rule in Afghanistan. It's keen to reassert its influence in the region, but it doesn't want to get bogged down in messy internal Taliban politics. Well, today, Moscow plays host to a group of Taliban envoys for talks on the future of Afghanistan. Let's get the latest now with Natalia Vasilieva, who's a Moscow correspondent at The Telegraph. Good morning, Natalia.
Good morning.
So just explain to us the setup, the background to this summit, please.
Well, the so-called Moscow format is the talks that we're having this morning. This is a very broad negotiations involving Russia, China, Pakistan, India, and a representative from the Taliban. Now, this is the first time that Taliban officials are facing envoys from this number of regional powers, and these talks do not feature any U.S. representatives, which might sound like a snub to Washington. However, Moscow has said that it was ready to host American officials, but they have decided not to come.
Indeed, the U.S. has said it was invited, but it is not attending. What will they be talking about today?
Well, as everywhere else, the rest of the world wants to avoid a humanitarian crisis, whereas obviously the international community is ready to pledge aid to Afghanistan. At the same time, no one really wants to recognize the Taliban at this point and lend them too much legitimacy. Another thing that Moscow is also anxious to see is the Taliban to make good on its promises to allow girls go back to secondary school. Moscow was actually one of the few countries that initially spoke really warmly of the Taliban during the surprise takeover earlier this year. But what President Putin recently said is that he would like to see Taliban to tackle terrorism and the production of drugs in the country in order to for Moscow to see the Taliban as a legitimate government.
It is a difficult balance that every nation has to strike now, isn't it? Which is to step in where help is absolutely needed. And, you know, the Taliban have no money. There is an immediate and urgent humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. But helping in and helping and stepping in requires to some certain degree allowing the Taliban a certain level of legitimacy.
Well, exactly. Right now, Afghanistan has $9 billion frozen in its foreign reserves, and they're desperate to get this money unlocked. The talks this morning could be a step towards doing this, because we are going to be seeing a large number of regional powers which would also want to see Afghanistan as a stable government. And the last thing they want is a humanitarian disaster on their doorstep. At the same time, the prospects for international recognition of the Taliban right now is very dim. And I guess what those countries are trying to get from the Taliban at this stage is some sort of assurances that I would say the minimal standards for human rights would be adhered to in this country.
And President Vladimir Putin has cautioned that there should be no hurry to officially recognize the Taliban's governance of Afghanistan, hasn't he?
Yes, exactly. The Russian ambassador to Kabul initially praised the Taliban during the takeover, saying that the situation in the Afghan capital was much safer than under the previous government. But later, both the Russian foreign minister and Vladimir Putin poured some water on expectations for international recognition, saying that they saw the threat of terrorism in the region increase since the Taliban takeover, and they would like to see some concrete steps, and that Russia's recognition is not on the table at this point.
How much of a coup is this, however, for the Taliban, knowing that despite this illegitimacy argument, they are sitting around the table with the likes of Russia, China, Pakistan and India?
Yeah, I mean, Taliban delegations have had those kinds of talks for a while now. But obviously, this is the first time they are facing representatives from so many countries. Obviously, the U.S. is key here, and we're not expecting, as I've said, a U.S. representative is not coming, although they have expressed their interest. I don't think the Taliban has much expectations for this point, but I think it's important for them to go to places like Moscow to see if they can if they can secure any support for things like humanitarian aid or any assurances that its foreign reserves might be unfrozen sometime soon.
What leverage do the other countries have, though? I mean, is it more complicated than just saying we are going to withhold aid?
Yes, but also we're talking about Central Asia, which is reliant on cross-border trade with Afghanistan. We're also talking about China, which is hoping to cash in on reconstruction and rebuilding the country. But there's also there's very little we understand what exactly countries like China and Russia can do on the ground to get the Taliban to stick to international rules, to respect women's rights and things like that.
How much of this is Russia trying to get back involved or assert a little bit more influence when it comes to Afghanistan? Because, I mean, the withdrawal of Soviet troops in 1989 after a 10-year occupation of Afghanistan still hurts. It was the first time that the world realised that you actually cannot take over Afghanistan if the Taliban are there.
Exactly. And this was a very painful moment in the Soviet history. And the Russian operation, the Russian occupation in Afghanistan, is often described as one of the things that eventually brought down the Soviet Union, that the cost of military involvement was just too much for the Soviet economy to bear. And this time around, Moscow is smarter. It wants to appear as the key mediator in matters concerning Afghanistan. But the last thing it wants to do is to get involved militarily and to send boots on the ground. It wants to appear to hold sway, but it doesn't really want to. It doesn't really want to get involved in matters on the ground. At the same time, another thing that Moscow is worried about is China's increasing influence in Central Asia, which used to be part of the Soviet Union. And through Afghanistan, Moscow is also trying to hold more sway in the entire region.
Indeed. And Russia has this tendency, doesn't it, to step in just at the moment when the rest of the world isn't sure what to do. It has had tremendous influence in, let's say, the civil war in Syria. And met and stepped up when the United States didn't know whether to take military action against Bashar al-Assad. Russia stepped in. Is Russia trying to carve out a role for itself on the global stage as the country that solves problems and steals a march on the likes of the US and China and at the same time?
Exactly. This could also be happening. The Moscow talks, that's the new round of which we're seeing this morning, they first started in 2017. And it was a rare moment when a Western country was hosting Taliban representatives, when there was a taboo on hosting people who have been described as terrorists and who are still designated as terrorists in Russia as well. And after hosting Taliban envoys in 2017, Russia was able to say, we are inviting them, we want to talk, we want to see how it goes. So when the takeover happened, Moscow was much more confident, and it was able to say that it has had contacts with those people for a while, and it trusts them, and it sees the situation as much more predictable because it has kept those line of communications open for a while.
Natalia Vasilieva, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. A committee investigating January's Capitol riot has unanimously supported holding Donald Trump's political aide in contempt of Congress. Steve Bannon was summoned to testify before the panel, but refused to do so. Well, let's get the latest now with Scott Lucas, Emeritus Professor of US Politics at the University of Birmingham. Good morning, Scott.
Very good morning, Emma.
So this was a unanimous vote to recommend holding Steve Bannon in criminal contempt for refusing to turn up.
It's a unanimous vote, but this committee, which was set up by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier this year, only has a few Republicans on it because almost all Republicans boycotted it. Significantly, those who are there, including Adam Kinzinger, who voted for the impeachment of Donald Trump over Trump's alleged incitement of the attack on the U.S. Capitol, and the vice chair of the committee, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the daughter of the former vice president, who also voted for Trump's impeachment and has been very, very vocal that there needs to be a reckoning through public hearings.
Why has he not turned up?
Oh, because Steve Bannon, first of all, doesn't really believe that Congress has any place in the U.S. government. He didn't believe it when he was Trump's campaign manager. He didn't believe it when he was Trump's chief strategist in the White House in 2017. Steve Bannon would be quite happy for the entire system, his words, not mine, to fall apart so he could come in and save it. But beyond that is the fact is that Donald Trump has in effect publicly ordered his former staff, four of whom have been subpoenaed by the committee, not just Bannon, not to turn up. Trump not only saying that, I have executive privilege, this should be confidential because I was president, but Trump continuing to push his falsehoods that the election was stolen from him last year. In other words, the entire justification for his call on that crowd on January 6th to go march on the Capitol and prevent the certification of Joe Biden as president.
You mentioned the issue of executive privilege there, which is something that Steve Bannon has actually used as an argument. And then you mentioned the Republican Liz Cheney, who said that Mr. Trump's and Mr. Bannon's arguments appear to reveal one thing, that they suggest that President Trump was personally involved in the planning and execution of January the 6th, and we will get to the bottom of that. That is an incredibly serious allegation to make.
It is. First, let's take on the legal position regarding executive privilege, Emma. The contrasting arguments are this, that the House committee says that someone who is no longer president can no longer claim executive privilege. They're no longer shielded by the office. Joe Biden, the current president, has waived executive privilege. In other words, he says he has no problem with having these hearings to find out what happened. But Trump will not give up that claim, of course. You know, Trump's never going to give up that claim, despite his lack of real legal knowledge. Now, in terms of what happened, which is the crux of this, yes. There is significant evidence that in the days leading up to the January 6th attack and on the day of the attack, Donald Trump tried to prevent Joe Biden from becoming president, that he tried to replace the head of the Justice Department, the acting attorney general, with a loyalist who would argue that Congress could not certify Biden and that supposed mass fraud had to be investigated, that Donald Trump put pressure on state legislators not to approve Biden, not to approve the electors for Biden, that Trump put pressure on Republican officials specifically, and that specifically why Steve Bannon is there, that Steve Bannon, the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, the former White House Social Media Director Dan Scavino, and the Pentagon Chief of Staff Kash Patel were all in discussions with Donald Trump on ways to prevent Congress, including the Vice President Mike Pence, from conducting the constitutional responsibility to verify the November vote. In other words, this was, Emma, an allegation of a coup to replace the Constitution, and that coup included summoning and dispatching hundreds of people to attack the Capitol and to threaten the execution of legislators and indeed of Vice President Mike Pence.
What does this now mean for the investigation and what the committee can and cannot establish when you have the key figures refusing to testify?
Well, it works on two fronts. First of all, Emma, the hearings have been proceeding with those witnesses who have answered the subpoenas. They do include the man that Donald Trump tried to install, his loyalist, as the acting attorney general, Jeffrey Clark, to block Biden's certification. The House has subpoenaed the organizers of the so-called Stop the Steal rallies, and they are not being commanded by Trump not to testify. On these four individuals specifically, if they continue to refuse to testify, we have the legal front, where, of course, the courts will determine the issue of executive privilege. But we now will also have the political drama of Steve Bannon being charged with and tried for contempt of Congress,
which arguably some might say will distract from the main agenda, which is to find out what happened on January the 6th.
I think it goes even farther for some, Emma, and that is that I recently returned from a trip to the States, to Georgia, first time in 2 years. But during that trip, I stayed with my sister and her husband. Now, both of them are never Trumpers. They are Republicans, but they're never Trumpers. But they said, look, why have these hearings? Why go through this in public? This will just increase the division. This will just increase the discord in America. So you have a mirror image here. I would argue, my own personal position, that if you're going to deal with division and discord, you have to shine a light on what actually happened, that you actually have to expose the extent to which the American system was threatened. But here, my sister and my husband, who I respect incredibly, are arguing that it's time to move on from January 6th, at least in the open. And I think that Donald Trump and his folks will be counting on the fact that Americans will just be tired of all of this, that they'll be tired and assume that it's time to get beyond January the 6th, even as, and here's the stinger in the tail, Emma, that Donald Trump is planning to run for president again in 2024.
Scott Lucas, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
.19 in Strasbourg, 7:19 here in London. Now, it is a given that any member of the European Union is bound legally by a judgment of the Court of Justice of the European Union, or the CJEU, or as it's been commonly known, the ECJ. It's not always been the easiest of rides. Countries, especially in the early days, challenged the court's supremacy in individual cases, and they generally lost. Poland, however, last week took a defiant step when a national court set aside whole chunks of EU law, saying they didn't apply to the Polish citizens. Well, the EU reacted straight away and yesterday laid out its response in Strasbourg. Let's examine this further now with Joanna Pluczynska, who's a political journalist for Reuters in Warsaw. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, everybody hoped perhaps that a trip to Strasbourg would help things. It didn't much, did it?
It seems like there were hours of disagreement in the European Parliament yesterday.
So yeah. Tell us what happened.
Basically, the Polish Prime Minister laid out his position, which he had previously laid out in a letter to EU leaders, where he argued that Poland's ruling was not unusual, that it was justified, and he basically warned against the creeping infringement of the possibility of oversight by the European Union that is unjustified, essentially.
Carry on.
And in turn, he was castigated by members of the European Parliament, by ministers, and by the European Commission head, Ursula von der Leyen.
Now, Ursula von der Leyen really hit back with a very powerful statement, didn't she? She said that Poland was calling into question the foundations of the European Union. This is not the traditional compromise which the EU generally tends to favour, is it?
I think the situation with Poland has been growing more and more tense steadily for years now. And I think this Constitutional Tribunal decision has really kind of changed the way that the European Union is approaching this. It's really putting its foot down, it seems. Although there have been calls by some countries to kind of go easy, by Angela Merkel, for example, to take a diplomatic approach, to be slow and steady and have calm discussions about this.
So what are the options open to the European Union and to the Court of Justice here?
So basically, there are three main options. What the European Union can do is open an infringement case against Poland for not applying EU law, for not following ECJ rulings. It can also launch a conditionality mechanism that can limit access to money, to access to grants for development and structural projects in the 2021-2027 budget, also to the recovery funds for COVID. And finally, Poland can have its voting rights suspended. So those are kind of the three main things that were laid out yesterday.
Now, a couple of them, let's say the taking Warsaw to court would possibly be the most likely option. And it wouldn't be the first time that Poland has been hauled before the CJEU for interim infringement of European Union principles. But seeing Poland lose access to money and chiding it in other ways will arguably be harder to do, won't they? Because they are politically weighted. And indeed, if you deprive funds to a member state, you're not depriving the government of the funds. You're effectively depriving the citizens of that state of money.
Yes, that's true. And I think it's very important to note how big of a difference European Union funds have made in Poland and how appreciated and also noted that is, how big of a difference these funds have made. It's built infrastructure in Poland. It's created jobs. It's completely changed the standard of living for a lot of people since Poland joined the European Union. So that is definitely something that could really hurt not just the government, but also Polish citizens.
One thing it could do as well is delay giving the money from the post-pandemic recovery fund. That could hurt as well, couldn't it? And that is an option.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's also worth noting in Poland right now, there is rising inflation that has concerned a lot of people. Prices are rising. So there is a sense that the economy is perhaps not doing as well as many would have hoped. And that recovery fund money would be helpful, would be appreciated, even though Poland did weather the coronavirus pandemic better than some countries, than most European countries. It still needs help. That's what many people are saying.
What about what other member states can do instead of having to go straight to the European Commission or be referred to the Court of Justice? There's a European Council summit in Brussels on, I think it's on Thursday, and EU leaders will be there. And the warning signs have already come that they will take the Polish Prime Minister to task there. There's the issue of personal influence now, isn't there?
Well, like I said, there have been calls to go easy and not overreact by Germany, I believe. But we will see. I mean, I think what we saw yesterday in the parliament was that EU leaders did take already a very, very strong position towards the Polish Prime Minister. And I imagine there will be a continuation of that.
Joanna Pleczynska, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Warsaw. You're listening to The Globalist. We're going to discuss the rise of the far right in Latin America now, which is not just restricted to Brazil's government under Jair Bolsonaro's stewardship. In Chile, José Antonio Kast has topped some polls ahead of next month's presidential vote. And in Argentina, a libertarian candidate is also performing strongly ahead of parliamentary elections there. So what's driving this shift to the right? Well, Monocle's Paige Reynolds has been hearing from our senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
I think it's an interesting trend overall in the region. Of course, it's very difficult to generalize because every country is different. But of course, you had a lot of kind of right-wing dictatorships in the continent in the 60s, in the 70s, even a little bit in the 80s. You look at Argentina, Chile, Brazil. And I remember growing up as a kid, clearly you see that someone has right-wing views, but they would never say, I would vote for the right. Far right, oh my God, that's almost impossible. It was a little bit of a taboo in a way. And a lot of countries, they didn't even had left-wing governments, but nobody mentioned the word right. But that is changing very much so. It's not a taboo. And when I say far right, I think it's a controversial term. For some candidates, some people don't agree with it. But what I mean is that they are further to the right than the traditional center-right parties. They are very much, I mean, just look at Europe. I think, in fact, those European parties, they were very influential. They are anti-immigration, very much pro-family, religious in a way. So things are changing. And I think Brazil perhaps was the start of all. I mean, we've elected a president that had far-right views, Bolsonaro. And I'm surprised to see that it's spreading out in the continent as well.
And maybe just on that kind of, if we stick to Brazil for a minute, you know, we've seen the power of the far right with his victory. He's now not doing so well in the polls, but he's still quite an electoral force, and that's still significant.
He is indeed. I mean, of course, his popularity is falling. It's very hard for him to be re-elected. But there is a certain sector of society, about 25 to 30%, that would vote for him no matter what. And if you ask me, Paige, even if Bolsonaro was not president, I think from now on, and I mean, look at the United States, look at Austria and many other countries, they are more kind of engaged and they know their views. You know, they feel very much attached to those ideals. So even if there's no Bolsonaro, I think the center-right and the center-left, they will struggle to get this vote because they are completely passionate about these ideas. And I wonder, we never had that in Brazil before, but I think those core Bolsonaro supporters, they will be there for him, no matter what. And they're sizable. 25% of the population is quite a lot, even if they don't win.
And I'm interested, what's the voter profile look like? What does a Bolsonaro supporter look like in Brazil? Can we kind of, you know, say what kind of age or gender or kind of occupation these people have? Or is it quite a mixed bag?
It's a hard one. I think at the moment, the core bag, it's in the region of the south of Brazil, which is the richest region as well, but very conservative, you know, very white. We also have in the north, I know it's both extreme regions, but the north and the center-west as well, they're quite agricultural. And I think the agricultural vote, people that work with agribusiness, they are very much core Bolsonaro supporters. And I think the religion is also a very strong factor. Evangelicals are increasing in Brazil, and I think that group stayed very loyal to Bolsonaro as well. So I think that's the trend. In terms of age, I wouldn't say so. And of course, men. I mean, if you look at the numbers, the vast majority of Bolsonaro supporters are men, but there's still a sizable number of women as well.
Now, that's interesting. So we're going to move on to a few other countries where we're seeing that far-right trend. And I think it's going to be interesting to see whether the voter profile kind of remains the same. But let's first talk about Chile, where they have presidential elections next month. The left does look likely to win. But in second place, we see a far-right candidate instead of a centre-right candidate. What does this tell us?
That's an interesting one, Paige, because yes, I do think, you know, Gabriel Boric, the center-left candidate, is the favorite to win, and he's been quite stable in the polls. And everybody was talking about how Chile is becoming progressive. There's a lot of, you know, people were protesting the streets against inequality. And let's remember, the candidate that is in power now, Sebastián Piñera, center-right, you know, that's been the tradition in Chile since their redemocratization. But interestingly, the second place now is a man called José Antonio Kast. and he's kind of a pro-Pinochet candidate. He said if Pinochet was alive, he would vote for him. That's super controversial, but there is a sizable part of Chile that believe in these ideals. And, you know, I mentioned immigration. Chile, you know, compared to other South American countries, is a fairly wealthy country in the region. So I think there is the beginning of an anti-immigration vote there as well, which is quite interesting. And he's beating the center-right candidate. So, you know, the left could win, but it's interesting to see that about 17%, more or less, of people are already willing to vote for him. He's climbing up in the polls at the moment.
It seems that people are kind of being pushed to the extremes. The centre just can't really deliver, I guess, in the same way. Maybe we can have a look at the presence of the far right in Argentina kind of just before we go. Interestingly enough, and this is where it comes back to voter profiles, it seems that younger people are warming up to fringe parties here.
That's why everything's so complex. That's why it's good to look country by country. Again, this man here, Javier Milei, he's not going to win the election. There'll be parliamentary elections next month in Argentina. But you know, his party, which is a fairly new party, had 13% in the primaries they had back in September, which is a very unique thing in Argentina they do before an election. And he describes himself... That's why I have to be careful with the term far right. But he says he's an anarcho-capitalist. But he's very much a fan of Trump and Bolsonaro. And, you know, he's very much libertarian, very conservative. And he does a very interesting look, Paige. I think his nickname is The Wig. He's got quite disheveled hair. He's a former rock star. I mean, he looks very interesting. You wouldn't imagine that he would be such a candidate. But there's something that's connecting, especially with young people. And I think, you know, we're talking before the interview, I think people want perhaps change as well. Of course, the economic situation in Argentina at the moment is not very well. So, I mean, it is interesting. It is very worrying, this trend in Latin America, I would say. Perhaps there is a reason why they started. Perhaps people were tired. Perhaps their life didn't improve with the center-right or center-left governments as well. So I'm not just saying, oh my God, those parties came to destroy everything. But it is a little bit worrying looking at what happened in the United States and in Europe as well.
That was Monocle's Fernanda Agosto-Pacheco there in conversation with Paige Reynolds. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 for much more coverage of both the presidential vote in Chile and the parliamentary elections in Argentina. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson, with the time at 7:33 here in London. A look now at the latest headlines. North Korea has confirmed that it successfully tested a new submarine-launched ballistic missile. State-run media says the missile had advanced control guidance technologies, which could make it harder to track. Pyongyang has carried out a number of weapons tests in recent weeks. Health leaders in England have said some COVID restrictions must be reintroduced immediately if the country is to avoid stumbling into a winter crisis. The NHS Confederation said ministers should bring in their so-called Plan B backup strategy, including mandatory face coverings in crowded spaces. And the 73rd Frankfurt Book Fair opens today under the moniker Reconnect. 2,000 exhibitors and 300 authors from 80 countries have gathered in the central German city. You can find out much more by heading to monocle.com/minute and by staying tuned to Monocle 24. This is The Globalist. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Isabel Knobel is co-head of the Europe programme at the think tank Voraus, and she joins us live from our headquarters in Zurich. A very good morning to you, Isabel.
Good morning, Emma.
And how is Dufourstrasse 90 this morning?
Very, very good this morning. Thanks.
Delighted to hear it. Right, let's have a look at what the Swiss papers are talking about today. Let's go straight to the Tages-Anzeiger. What have you found?
Well, the Tages-Anzeiger as well as NZZ have prominently on the front the affair around the Credit Suisse. So yesterday, two proceedings were concluded, and the Swiss Financial Market Supervisory Authority accuses the bank of serious violations of supervisory law in this very famous case around the top banker Iqbal Khan in this spy affair. And there was also an agreement reached in the Mozambique affair, which cost the bank around $475 million of dollars.
So just explain a little bit more about what the Financial Market Authority, FINMA, I think it's called.
FINMA.
Exactly what it's accused Credit Suisse of doing.
It has accused Credit Suisse that there were serious organizational deficiencies in connection with the surveillance activities between 2016 and 19. And they say that in most cases, these decisions were made, or these decisions about these observations were made informally without comprehensible reasons.
So tell us a little bit more about what the consequences are now for Credit Suisse.
So if Credit Suisse in the future wants to shadow people again, the shading must be approved from the very top. So it needs to be approved by the CEO, it needs to be approved by the board of directors, and there will also be a new set of internal reporting measures that Credit Suisse needs to apply to, although they already have set numerous measures in place.
Just tell us a little bit more about what this now does to Credit Suisse's reputation. It is not a good thing for a Swiss bank to find itself under the spotlight for the wrong reasons.
Certainly not. No, I mean, apart from being obliged to pay this 475 million, obviously is a very there's a lot of reputational damage, because also when you have a look at the Mozambique case, Credit Suisse will, for example, no longer be able to, or has serious conditions when it comes to, for example, lending new credits to countries that are financially weak or corruption prone. So this, I think, is a real bad damage to the reputation of the bank.
Indeed. I mean, if you are in Switzerland, and you know, there are plenty of very big banks to choose from if you are in Switzerland, how much damage do you think that this will now do to Credit Suisse's reputation?
That is hard to tell for me. I think it's not the first case in this regard. I mean, there have been in the past a lot of lawsuits to banks, so it's hard for me to judge whether the reputation will be seriously damaged, but I'm sure it will have consequences, as it already has. I mean, this was quite a scandal in Switzerland.
Let's move on to a story from the NZZ, which shines a light on the very fractious relationship between Switzerland and the European Union.
Yes. So the NZZ reports about a meeting of the Swiss MedTech Federation yesterday on this Congress. The association criticized both the Swiss government, but also the EU, because when the government ended the negotiations about a institutional agreement in May, there were new rules imposed on both sides. So to say, Switzerland, when producers want to export products into the EU, they have to face new rules, and that has made it much more expensive to export products for Swiss manufacturers. And these costs, they are estimated by the industry association to about 110 million in the first instance, and plus 75 million each year, which is not so much when you look at the total sales, but still this could hurt Swiss exporters. And on the other hand, also Switzerland has imposed some rules or regulations for products coming from the EU to Switzerland, and that this might be more difficult in the future for Swiss for Switzerland. And so the industry association criticizes also the Swiss government, because in the future there might be products missing. They talk about a survey, or they did a survey which says that the industry fears that about 1/8 of all medical products from the EU could no longer be imported to Switzerland in the future, which could have serious consequences for let's say operations, could make them impossible in the worst case. And so this shortage is quite a problem.
Indeed. I mean, what effect does this do on the the Swiss government's popularity among citizens who are told that, OK, in a few years' time or maybe even sooner, the medicines upon which you depend may not be able to be imported as easily as they could be?
I think it's always a question of the framing. I'm not sure if people in Switzerland actually already notice that this might happen. And as more as we read about this, I'm sure that people will get or will more criticize the Swiss government because that's something which is the most important to people. I think that they can be healthy and that the products that they need, that they are there. So I think this could seriously harm the reputation of the government if this is going to be a real problem.
Now, burning issue being mentioned in the Tages Anzeiger this morning, which is the issue of going on a ski lift this this winter. There is the 3 G's that you have to show in Switzerland. Unless it's geimpft, genesen, getested, isn't it?
That's right.
Well, let's try and translate this. This is vaccinated, recovered, or tested, isn't it? So this is a thing that's a kind of a natural, normal thing that happens when you wander around in Switzerland. But are we going to have to do this when we present ourselves on the very large open-air ski lifts and on the slopes this year? Hugely controversial question.
Yes, I think that's the fear of many, many ski lovers in Switzerland. So this is quite a heated debate currently in Switzerland. And so the skiing areas, the Cable Cars Association, yesterday said that there will no certificate be required for ski lifts in winter. But then the reaction of the government or of the health department was pretty fast and pretty harsh as well, because they said that in the end it will be the Swiss government who decides this. So this is a fight not yet decided.
And it's highly controversial given the fact that if you are going skiing in Austria and Italy, you will have to take your so-called 3G certificate with you, won't you? So Switzerland is kicking back slightly here.
Yes, that's true. The article mentions that there is, I think, one skiing area in Switzerland already that has said that there will be a certificate requirement, but the others are not so far. And we'll see how this turns out, whether people from Austria, maybe also Italy, come to Switzerland for skiing.
So they don't have to wear a mask. I think what people are all waiting for now is a statement from Seilbahn Schweiz, which is the body which looks after cable cars and ski lifts. I mean, surely, with everybody else wearing masks, it's all the pretty well-regulated affair lower down on the slopes. What is the problem with wearing a mask on a ski lift or in a cable car?
I'm not sure if it's so much a problem to wear a mask in the cable car, because that's what the Cable Car Association also suggests. So that would be similar to what you have or to the regulation that you currently have in public transportation in Switzerland. But on the skiing slopes, for sure, there will be that will be highly contested whether people will have to wear a mask or not. I think most people won't be ready to do that.
It might get a bit cold and wet. Isabel Knobel from Voraus. Thank you so much for joining us on the line from our Zurich bureau. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. We head to the Balkans in a moment.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
. 7:45 here in London. Let's head to the Western Balkans now for a roundup of the stories making news there. Our man in the region, Guy Delaunay, joins us on the line from the Slovenian capital, Ljubljana. A very good morning to you, Guy.
Good morning, Emma, and good morning, everybody.
Nice to have you with us. Right, what's hitting the headlines where you are?
Well, I think the big thing really is what's going on in Bosnia, because today we've got a session in the Parliament of the Republika Srpska region, and keen listeners may recall that Bosnia is basically split into two. You've got Republika Srpska, where most of the ethnic Serbs live, and then you've got the Federation, which is where most of the ethnic Croats and Bosniak Muslims live. And Republika Srpska is, you know, rattling its sabre a little bit, talking about pulling away from the rest of Bosnia. This is all being led by Milorad Dodik, who's the senior ethnic Serb politician in Bosnia. He's the member of the presidency for the ethnic Serbs in Bosnia. And basically, the session today in the National Assembly, it's going to be all about establishing a medicines agency. And the reason this is significant is because it would take away the authority of the National Medicines Agency, transfer it to this Republika Srpska Medicines Agency. And this is the first shot in this campaign that Milorad Dodik's been staging for quite some time now, of withdrawing Republika Srpska from the national institutions of Bosnia. And people are saying, well, look, this is putting the integrity of Bosnia, which frankly never looks that solid, at even greater risk.
Indeed. I mean, what are his chances of this actually being a successful campaign?
Well, this is the thing. I don't think he's actually got the support where it counts. And when I say the support where it counts, I mean in Serbia itself. Because we've had the president of Serbia, Aleksandar Vučić, come out and say that Serbia will support any decisions made in Bosnia which are supported by all three constituent peoples. And by the constituent peoples of Bosnia, he means the ethnic Serbs, the ethnic Croats, and the Bosniak Muslims. So in other words, if the ethnic Croats and the Bosniak Muslims don't go along with Milorad Dodik's campaign, Serbia has not got Milorad Dodik's back. And basically without that, I can't see him succeeding in the long term. The question is what his short-term ambitions are.
Tell us, though, that there is an issue of an accordion player. Explain that that relevance to this tale, please.
Well, that's right. Earlier this week, and I think it's always worth talking about Balkan politicians and their musicians, especially as I once ended up singing Let It Be with Ivica Dacic, who at that point was the Prime Minister of Serbia. Thank you very much. Proudest moment of my career, Emma. certainly my singing career. In this case, though, Milorad Dodik, he brought an accordionist into the presidency building of Bosnia earlier this week. I've sat him down in his office with a bunch of cronies, and they all brought out the old rakia and started drinking and singing all sorts of songs. And Milorad Dodik called up his mum on the phone and started singing, you know, My Dear Old Mother down the line to him, which was taken in many quarters as not as a mark of respect for his mum, but disrespect for the solemnity of the office of the presidency and the nation of Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Finally, I mean, it's just the idea of bringing someone into an office into disrepute briefly, Guy. How serious an issue is that?
Well, I mean, it's more of the same from Milorad Dodik, really. But it doesn't augur well for Bosnia, which has been judged by the European Union to have made no progress on all the important things it's meant to be doing towards European Union membership.
Guy Delaunay, thank you so much for joining us on the line. That was Monocle's Balkans correspondent there, live on The Globalist on Monocle 24. Finally today, the Welsh Government has announced a drive to persuade more young adults to stay in their homeland. It follows concerns that the percentage of working-age citizens is dropping to worryingly low levels. So why do young Welsh people leave to pursue careers elsewhere, and what could be done to bring them back? Well, we thought we'd put this to the test with three members of Monocle's Welsh contingent, a great one who all grew up in Wales but now live elsewhere. Monocle's Rhys James is based at our London headquarters behind the glass as I speak, and has been hearing from our Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis and our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, James Chambers.
So I should start by saying Borada to Thomas, or good morning.
Borada, Rhys.
And to James in Hong Kong, Noswaita, or good evening.
Good evening, Rhys. Noswaita.
Thomas, let's start with you. This Welsh Government initiative, do you think it's broadly kind of positive? Is it what needs to be done to persuade more people to stay in Wales?
I think it broadly is quite positive, actually, because I think this is quite an interesting time for Wales. Obviously, if you go back to the Brexit referendum, I think there were only five parts of the country that voted to remain in the EU and the rest voted to leave. And I think, you know, that sort of created this sense that, you know, maybe there was a sense for majority of voters, at least back then, kind of wanting a sort of different direction. Obviously, the government in charge in Cardiff wasn't for Brexit and has spoken quite publicly about how it's been managed from London and the effect in very tangible ways that's having on all parts of Wales. You know, I think Wales's issue maybe for a long time has been, you know, the economy's been skewed to the public sector. So I believe that the National Health Service, the NHS, is still the largest employer in Wales. And, you know, jobs like teaching and other public sector jobs like those are still kind of the dominant ones. And I think, you know, I've always had a sense every time I've gone back to visit, I'm from just outside Cardiff. So going back to Cardiff and seeing kind of the way that city has changed since I was young, I mean, you can definitely see there is this sort of sense of entrepreneurialism that exists in Wales. And I think, you know, this plan that we've heard announced by the sort of finance ministry in Wales, you know, to try and bring about more of that, I think will be essential if people want to look at Wales and see that possibilities can unfold there and that you can create a quality of life for yourself that actually would be akin to, say, the adventure of someone like London, for example. And I think, you know, perhaps when you're a nation the size of Wales, perhaps, you know, the level of ambition, the level of sort of wanting to push sort of new boundaries and things maybe isn't as keen, perhaps. I don't want to speak out of place here, but maybe it isn't as keen, given that you have sort of England, the big powerhouse right next door, with all of those opportunities there. But I think one thing just finally, Rhys, I'd say, is that, you know, I spoke to Mark Drakeford, the First Minister of Wales, a few months ago for Monocle 24. I thought it was interesting, his characterisation of the way Wales had experienced the pandemic, actually. And I think that he said that it had given him a sense that, you know, people in Wales do actually kind of realise in quite a keen way now that Wales is a very distinctive place and distinct place. And the way that the pandemic, for example, was handled in Wales was pretty different to the way it was handled in other parts of the UK. And that perhaps has given kind of a different sense of pride or identity that I think could perhaps be something to be tapped into in a proposal like this, to keep young people in Wales, to keep them proud of where they're from, and to contribute to a country that, you know, there's really quite a lot to be done in many ways, you know, in terms of the kind of economy Wales has at the moment, that, you know, there really could be a lot of potential for young people, if they did want to stay, to make a real impact, if you like.
There's lots to kind of unpack there, Tomos. James, the importance of keeping young people in Wales and making sure that people are going to university in Wales and those opportunities are there. How do you think that can be done? How can we create those opportunities for the best and brightest in Wales?
Well, I guess the key thing that Tomos mentioned is jobs and attractive jobs. He mentioned the NHS, and he's from Cardiff. I grew up in Swansea, which is the kind of second city about an hour west. And, you know, the joke when we were growing up is that, you know, the only employer in town is the DVLA, which is the kind of vehicle licensing authority. So it's the one you get you apply for the driving license in the UK. And that's one of the, perhaps one of the main reasons that people might know Swansea around the UK, is that we have the DVLA there. So that was the one of the biggest employers alongside perhaps call centres. So there wasn't really much to entice people to stay in Swansea, or even to come back if you graduated from a university somewhere else. So I think, you know, they really have to focus on getting large companies and large employers and good jobs to come to Wales. I mean, famously, there's only one FTSE 100 company in Wales, the car insurer Admiral. We seem to do well in the car industry, maybe. When you can count things like that on one hand, you know you've got a bit of a problem. So I think it's trying to convince large companies to come to Wales. And we often look at Ireland as a case study of a country that has been able to kind of pick itself up and make the most of its advantages. And perhaps Wales can always learn a lot from that. I'm not going to go into the whole independence debate, but, you know, there are certainly things that Wales can do to build on its brand. But I wouldn't discount the value of the Welsh diaspora either. Just because people leave Wales, it's not necessarily a brain drain. You know, we're in Canada, we're in Hong Kong, you know, flying the flag. And who knows, one day we may come back.
Yeah, the independence debate for another day, gentlemen. Briefly before you go, Tomos, what could tempt you back?
Well, it's quite a good question, that, Rhys, actually. I think the quality of life is very good. Again, I think, you know, to go back to the language, the government has put a goal to achieve 1 million Welsh speakers by 2050, I think it is. And I think feel as though maybe it'd be nice to play a part in that. Maybe, as I say, not quite now, but maybe down the line. But I think if you look like things like the Welsh language economy, there's a very rich cultural sector, lots of Welsh language production houses producing TV and films, some of which have been picked up by international sort of broadcasters. And I think the food and drink sector is really exciting too. And I think there are very sort of clear gaps in the market. You know, I think if you look at hospitality, Cardiff, for example, could have much more, you know, but much bigger array of sort of good, interesting hotels, for example, you know, for international visitors. And I think all these things sort of matter. I think it kind of has to go hand in hand in a way that, you know, people from elsewhere want to come and sort of set up in Wales, but also people at home feel that there's enough sort of exciting things or things that would make a change or fill a gap in a market that they want to contribute to. So I'm not sure, maybe to be a bit sort of softier by the end, but I think definitely sort of being close to family and friends would be quite nice again one day. So that's definitely sort of a goal for later down the line, Rhys, I'd say.
And James, same question to you. Do you think you go back to Swansea? Or are you happy with your new life in Hong Kong?
Well, I mean, I spent over more than half of my life outside of Wales now, but I'm still a very proud Welshman. I definitely echo what Thomas has just said. When I left Wales, and perhaps for the last 15 or 16, 17 years, I'd never even contemplated the idea of moving back to Wales. I always perhaps considered that if I'd ever go home, it would be to London. But that's completely changed now. And I'm actually, you know, seriously considering, you know, going back to Wales and having a life there close to family and having a bit more space, you know, being by the sea. I'm actually questioning whether I could or would want to live in London again. So, you know, I'd say it's gone from being an impossibility to something that I actively considering in some point in the future. I wouldn't say it's imminent, but I'd say Wales is definitely back on my agenda.
James Chambers there, ending that report by making a bid to be the next Cardiff Bureau Chief for Monocle 24. My thanks to Monocle's Welsh Dragons, Rhys James, Thomas Lewis and James Chambers for that look at what it means to be Welsh in 2021. Well, that's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Rhys James, Daniel Bate and Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Nora Hull was looking after the sound. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday London time and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.